It's easy to practice exploring new worlds when we're still exploring our own. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Explorers into difficult and unknown terrains face a whole host of challenges and hurdles, not all of them known beforehand. That fact itself is common to exploration efforts, regardless of the environment. Whether Amundsen in the Antarctic, Bagnold in the Libyan desert, or the Apollo astronauts on the moon, a key task is to set and later adjust appropriate goals given what's known going in. The ability to plan, adapt, and choose suitable tactics and strategies to achieve those goals is essential, and success relies on the application of the right technologies, relevant scientific knowledge, and critical and creative thinking. Even as we reach out into the solar system, there remain unexplored places here on the Earth. They're often remote from human habitation, difficult to access, and challenging to operate in. Each poses its own challenges, but the skills learned operating there are among those needed to explore the Moon, Mars, and anywhere else we might send space missions. The experiences of terrestrial explorers are a valuable guide to those preparing to undertake analogous expeditions beyond our home planet. Dr. Simon Donato is a trained geologist and endurance athlete and host of the television series Boundless. As founder of Adventure Science, he has organized and led expeditions into remote areas while conducting scientific surveys and reconnaissance. I spoke to him during his recent visit to Western University about combining science and adventure in difficult environments, and how the two complement each other. So, good afternoon, Dr. Donato, and welcome to Western Worlds.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming. And so, when you're working and exploring new, underexplored or new areas that are unfamiliar, how does the planning for an expedition like that start?
The planning, it's the simplest part. It's the Google research. So, you know, Google and Wikipedia are my high level friends. So if I get a lead on an area that sounds interesting, first thing I want to do is find out what research has been done there before. What kind of exploration has been done? What do people know about the area? So once I do that, I compile my list of articles. You know, in the perfect world, you don't find anything, and you know it's ripe for exploration. If there's a bit of research done, that can be helpful too. You dive in and you see what's been done. So, for example, the Beyond Roads expedition I did in Oman in 2011, the Royal Geographic Society had sponsored an expedition through there in the early 70s. So I was able to pull on that data and then build my own expedition from that.
When you're planning to go out into a place that is so remote and so poorly supported, what mix of skills do you need to bring along on your team?
That's a good question. To execute these expeditions requires a wide variety of skills, and I certainly don't possess all of them, which is why I need a team. It really depends. It's expedition to expedition dependent. So if we're doing continental expeditions in North America, typically we'll have one or two people handling logistics who will be on the ground with us, basically drop us off, pick us up at the end of each day, support us in the field, provide the necessities of life, basically, oftentimes handle most of the cooking, move camps for us. So that allows the researchers and the athletes to really focus on doing what they're there to do. So, you know, in terms of other skills, we've covered the logistics. You know, you've got researchers, so you've got academics there who have a good understanding of things that we might be getting into. So if it's archaeologic, you've typically got an archaeologist. Geologic, you've got that expertise. exercise physiology we've tackled in the past. So, you know, it's about bringing in the right people to support that. And then on the athletic side, it's bringing in, one, people that you trust and that you know are going to be an asset in the field and that aren't going to limit you in any way. Usually it's an experience and fitness-based thing. Secondly, you want people who are enthusiastic and are open to learning and they're interested in being scientific observers. So, you know, those are typically the skills. And then there are some technical skills dependent on the area. Rock climbing if necessary, rope work, whatever.
I guess it depends a lot on how remote the terrain is, but how self-sufficient are you typically in these expeditions?
Self-sufficiency is entirely dependent on where we are and what our access is like. On some expeditions, you know, we're prepared to take care of ourselves for a week or more. Other expeditions, we've got enough food and water to last the day.
Okay.
And that's it.
And are you typically in communication with the outside world during these times? Or?
Again, it's dependent on where we operate. You know, working in the Middle East, for example, communications are very limited there. And, you know, we use a sat phone only for emergencies. So, no, there was no communication until we got back to a major city. Working in North America, yeah, it's a little easier. I mean, sometimes you can be seemingly in the middle of nowhere and pick up a signal on your phone so you can send a tweet or something like that.
Yeah, that coverage is getting pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah, the coverage is getting better for sure. And when we're working on the continent, we'll typically have our daily summary, daily wrap-up, and then provide that to the people or the person who handles PR for us, and she will spread it to media outlets or at least post it on our website or a blog or something like that.
So I'm curious about the science aspect of this kind of exploration work. What sorts of science goals have you had in the past? What kinds of science have you been doing on these expeditions?
Well, the science we typically do is citizen science. It's observational. When we go out there for the hard stuff, we typically don't collect samples of anything. It's purely observational. In the past, we've done search and rescue projects where we approach it from more of a scientific angle, trying to use reason, deductive logic to get where we want to go. And it's still best guess at the end of the day. We've done exercise physiology projects where we look at things like core strength, where we look at muscle damage based on markers that are found in blood and urine. We've done geology, anthropology projects as well, where we're going in trying to identify sites for future research work. So, you know, I always view it as we're the high-level pass. We go through, for most of our projects, and we do a rapid assessment of what's in an area. And then we provide that information to the experts. So now they can high-grade sites based on their interest and their area of expertise and can better focus their field seasons and hopefully save some money.
Okay. And if you're doing that kind of maybe scouting work for a later expedition, do you have to plan it differently? Do you have to think about an expedition differently when it's that kind of scouting or reconnaissance as opposed to a more detailed follow-on?
You certainly approach a scouting expedition differently than you do, like, our exercise physiology study, where that was a scientific study. We wrote a paper after that, and, you know, you had to pass through ethics approval and the normal things you have to do when you're in academia. The scouting missions, they're a lot looser. You know, we go in there with certain goals and aims, but predominantly it's move quickly through these areas, cover ground, record what you find, move on. So, you know, it's about collecting enough data to be useful to researchers, taking good photographs, making sure you georeference all the sites that you find, and, you know, observing as much as you can, and then providing that information. So, yeah, they're two very different methods, and in some respects, you would even bring different people in.
So, considering that some of the logistical and the practical aspects of mounting an expedition like that, is it difficult to integrate the science? Is it difficult to balance the science work, or does it flow, or how does...
I'd say I haven't had a great difficulty balancing science. You know, some of the projects, again, because we self-fund and we kind of move light and fast, some of the projects are harder to execute than others. For example, we did a core strength study on ultramarathon runners a couple of years ago. And all the athletes, well, we had a control group and we had a group on a certain program that we had designed specifically for runners. So you run into issues of sample size. You run into issues of, okay, the ideal way to do this would be having 3D morphometric analysis to look at running gait and how running gait changes through the race, and does that follow along with somebody's perception of discomfort and pain as you go along. So things that are just impossible without having a big university behind you. But, you know, we do what we can, and there's still valuable research that comes out of it, but, you know, it's never really going to be written up in a paper. It's just more coffee table chat. But, right, again, most studies don't leave the laboratory.
Yeah, of course.
And even if they're looking at athletes, they're going to put them on a treadmill or put them on a bike, as opposed to measuring live, real time in a race.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the areas we try and bridge.
Okay. You've also worked in resource geology. And how different do you have to treat searching for resources, searching for economic potential, as opposed to doing scientific exploration?
Yeah, I mean, being a petroleum geologist, your job every day was to find oil, get more oil out of a known reserve, plan drilling programs. I mean, there was certainly a bottom line, you know, financial focus with everything that you did. At the same time, there was a little bit of freedom to do kind of pure research in there, because getting a better understanding of the geologic system would usually help you improve extraction at the end of the day. When you cross over to adventure science, you know, it's very different, because you get to follow your interests. And I'm not constrained by any financial directives or program objectives, anything like that. It's simply go out there, observe what we find, or, you know, if there's an interesting question that we want to pursue and try and find an answer to, you know, we've got the freedom to do that. So I don't want to say your hands are tied by industry, because that's certainly not the case, but you're there for an entirely different reason. You're there to make money for shareholders, to pull oil out of the ground and help fuel global growth, essentially. With adventure science, we're there to answer scientific questions that have been hanging out there and people haven't approached them for a variety of reasons.
Okay. And I guess thinking of resources at the scale of the adventure science work, have you ever been in a situation where you use local resources? Do you live off the land at all, or do you externally support that stuff?
Today we've only executed these projects bringing in all of the resources that we need, in the sense of food, water, lights, all that stuff.
Yeah.
We haven't had to live off the land yet. We have a few of the participants and I have talked about some studies, some projects where we could do something like that. I'm a little hesitant to do that, because it's not necessary yet. And, you know, to go out there and hunt or take from the land simply because we can, as opposed to having that need, it feels a little bit superfluous to me and unnecessary. I'm not a hunter. I respect those who hunt, and I can appreciate the reasons why. I would have a hard time, you know, killing something unless it was, you know, kind of a life or death situation. But on the other hand, we do draw local resources, in the sense of we'll hire local people. We've had boat drivers in the past and the like. You know, we'll go to areas and do our shopping and purchases there. So, you know, we support the local economy in some respects. But yeah, we usually bring in what we need.
What about contingency planning for when things don't go nominally? When you're in very, very remote areas, how do you structure a mission such that you can handle the unexpected?
That's an excellent question. Contingency planning is very important for what we do. But at the same time, when we really go on a little more high risk, more exposed expeditions, I go with guys who have a high risk tolerance.
Right.
And they know that there is potential, if they get hurt, that they may not get out of there. So we go in with sat phones. We use spot trackers most often. We're on radio. and we communicate regularly. But in some of these areas, if you get hurt, you're hours away from getting a helicopter out of there. You know, and the sat phones aren't always working everywhere, and the GPSs aren't always working everywhere. I mean, communications are very tough the further afield you go, oftentimes. So, you know, we go in there with that kind of knowledge. At the same time, try and mitigate. And you don't take unnecessary risks if you can avoid them. Moving through the backcountry, though, there's always slip and fall risks. There's always head down, walk into a tree branch, take it in the eye risk. You know, there's just kind of that inherent risk that's there. But, you know, we're never going to ask somebody, well, okay, we want you to free climb that cliff face there to take a look at the top. You know, that's unnecessary most often. So, yeah, it's about taking calculated risks out there, but there are inherent risks in what we do. And if you mitigate them too much, you handcuff the expedition.
And have you been in that position before where you've had to say that, you know, this target isn't reachable because we don't think it's worth the risk, or even this expedition?
I haven't had to cancel an expedition because of difficulty yet. I've certainly had to adjust our objectives and our targets out there because of inaccessibility. Oman is another great example. Even North Dakota last year, in the spring. I mean, you're just on these eroded knife edge ridges and, you know, it's muddy or it's dry or whatever. You've got to make a decision based on the terrain. It'd be really cool if I could walk out there and see what's at the end of this ridge. But at the same time, if I fall, I'm screwed because it is a long, painful, bumpy way down, or, you know, a free fall through the air. In Oman, same thing. You know, there's opportunities to swim between some islands or swim embayments. We don't know much about the currents out there. We didn't have local knowledge for that thing, for that, to answer that question. So, you know, you strike an island off the list, even though it'd be fascinating to get there, because you don't have the boat, you don't take the risk. Free climbing in Oman, same kind of thing.
Yeah. So judgment and equipment and safety.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about exercising good judgment based on skill level of your people, equipment that you have, and, you know, what the research goals are. If the research goals are you've got to see everything at the top of all of those cliffs, then you bring out a crew who knows how to climb, you bring out the ropes, and you do things properly. If it's we're going to do a fast pass through as much of this terrain as we can cover, knowing that there's going to be a few gaps because it's just too difficult to go down or up from where you are, you accept that, and it's just a reality of the expedition. So, you know, I certainly have the expectation that the athletes who are coming in are telling the truth on their resumes. I usually only bring people that I know and trust, because that just makes for a better experience for everyone.
And so do you have some process of vetting your crews?
Definitely. Like I mentioned, I vet people simply by knowing them. Mm-hmm. Although, again, if the expedition allows it, I'm happy to bring in people that I don't know. Obviously, I'll interview them first. Usually, I don't need much more than an email interview. If somebody is an athlete, you know, you can get an athletic resume. You can look up race results online right now to see if they're telling the truth about, you know, doing well in a certain race or not. But, you know, a lot of it has to do with enthusiasm. There are people out there who, you know, may not be as fit as myself or some of the others that I bring, but they make up for it in enthusiasm. And they're very good listeners. They're excellent observers in the field. And, you know, they've just got the general stamina and mental toughness to be a great team member, because that's a big part of it too. It's about being a good team member, being able to work with your peers. And, you know, at the end of the day, you want to have fun.
Right.
Yeah, because people are taking their vacation time to do this stuff. It's not a job for most of us.
Okay. So speaking of enthusiasm, there's a lot of places still to explore on the Earth. Which of these have maybe got your attention to go to soon?
A lot of great places left to explore. I'd certainly love to get to Madagascar. There's an area called the Singi there, the Great Singi, and it's basically a karst landscape. It's huge. I mean, the written word describes it as razor sharp, and it's basically just this foreboding limestone forest that is highly underexplored. Now, my interest there is that, you know, Madagascar is also the home to the endemic lemurs. It's also home to rapid deforestation and a massive mining expansion. So it's pushing these lemurs to the brink. My curiosity about the Singi Forest is that I wonder if it's some kind of refugia. If you get in there, would you find species that are on the brink elsewhere, but you still have these populations living in there? Because it is forested in the bottom of these karst canyons. So it's just, it's an area that nobody knows anything about. British Guiana, another area where they've got something like 80, 90% plus of their primary rainforest still left. It's adjacent to Brazil and Venezuela, which have the famous tepuis, which are these sandstone, Precambrian sandstone mountains, essentially. And it's ripe for exploration. That's a jungle project. Lots to do in the Arctic, lots to do in the Antarctic. So, yeah, I've done the research on a handful and handful of areas, and when the opportunity comes around, I'll be able to pull the trigger and go.
Cool. Well, plenty of places to go to then, and hopefully you'll get to see some of those soon.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just heard from Simon Donato, and I think I like his job.
It's probably the best job you could have.
It's a pretty good job, yeah. I mean, he gets to go on all kinds of little adventures to interesting places that people don't go to very much. That's fun.
Yeah. And then I think having a geology background, he probably, even where he goes, I think at least in the starting few years, he might be like, oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you study rocks and if you go somewhere else, it's probably the first thing you will mm-hmm. start thinking in your mind whether you want it or not.
Well, and especially in desert type places, which is some of the environments that he's gone to, you're not going to see anything but rocks and
yeah.
geological type materials. So you better be interested in looking at that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even like for me, like I don't study rocks or meteorites, but like being part of this program, like I learned so much about it. Like everywhere I go, I'm like, wait, that looks dark. Is that a meteorite? Or is that, what kind of rock is that? You know, like even though like I don't study them, just knowing a little bit about them just changes your perspective anywhere you go.
Yeah, for sure. You know, once you know a little bit about something, you start seeing it everywhere where it is.
Yeah.
And it's interesting as an analogy to the sort of short duration planetary surface sorties that you imagine as the first missions to go someplace. Like the Apollo type missions where it was a couple of days on the surface of the moon and they're just sort of quickly looking around. Because as you said, they're not doing the detailed scientific investigations. They're kind of looking for interesting sites, quick characterization. So it's interesting as an analogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, surely, you could use that, as he says, like sometimes they've used it for, you know, sometimes scientific purposes as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and I think the overall general idea is it's, you know, it's an adventure, like a TV show. Mm. People want to look for interesting places. They want to know about this interesting places rather than going in detail about the scientific words or, you know, going into the really scientific details. Which people really don't care. I think they really care about the big picture and how that place is different from, you know, the rest of the world, I would say.
Yeah, and there are some vacations where you kind of just, you know, paddle around in a kayak and look at pretty things. But knowing a bit about the context is appealing to me, I guess. And I kind of like the idea of a vacation with a mission.
Yeah.
With a goal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a way that we can use this kind of thing to train people for exploration type tasks on the Earth or even in space. I wonder if some of the skills that you need to do this kind of work are similar to what you'd use in other places.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think, as he says, like, you need a kind of preparation for how you go into these missions or his short adventures, I would say. Mm-hmm. But you also need the kind of people you take with you. You need to be precise on what kind of people they are, what's their, you know, fitness level and things like that. I think that kind of extrapolates to the fact that, you know, if you plan long distance journeys in space or even just to the moon, you need to have those kind of basics. And I think these kind of short adventure gives you the idea of whether if you can deal with a set of people for 10 days
mm-hmm.
or 1 month before just heading to, I don't know, next star. And turns out you cannot hang out with those people for more than 5 days.
Yeah.
You know, But yeah, the psychological effects are really important. I think adventures like this can help, even a bit by bit, if people are interested in learning from such adventures.
Yeah, and you think, you have to work in isolation. You have to work with a small team of people. You have to make strategic decisions kind of on your own, isolated from external support that relate to mission accomplishment and maybe even survival, depending on how difficult the situation becomes. And those are the kind of things you have to do in a lot of difficult environments, so.
Yeah, and I think he talked about this time where, you have to decide whether to do this or not, whether it will affect your perspective on the mission or your ability to do the rest of the mission, whether to survive, you'll be able to survive or not,
this
life and death situations. And I think it's kind of relates to the space exploration side because, in Apollo 13 or something, you can get into those situations and then you need to have people with you who can think, focus and think quickly.
Mm-hmm.
These kind of missions are exactly what happens if you're away from, if you're 5 years or 5 hours away from the next hospital or even someone coming you to pick up if something happens, that's probably the mission you would want to understand to extrapolate it to space exploration.
Yeah. And even, when you're planning something like this, you want to learn how to plan an operation like this such that those difficult situations are unlikely to arise, right? And you have to think about that stuff in space missions as well. I mean, what does that environment present to you?
Mm-hmm.
And how can you avoid the worst consequences or the awkward and difficult situations that may arise?
The good thing about this kind of adventure is like you're not on a spacecraft, so you have less kind of difficulties. Yeah, you're not wearing spacesuit. That's true.
Yeah.
And also the fact that, you are in the gravity, where you have gravity.
That's right.
So there are lots of things that are simplified, but still harder.
Yeah, and as bad as the weather can get in these places, you can still breathe.
Yeah.
And you can still go outside.
Yeah.
So if everything fails, you don't die immediately.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I remember asking him about whether he ever relies on local resources, whether he sort of lives off the land. And, I think he answered that from the perspective, no, we don't do hunting and things like that.
Yeah.
Which is something that you also can't do.
Yeah.
In space.
Mm-hmm.
But on occasion, no matter where you go on Earth, you will be within hundreds of thousands of kilometers at the most from human beings.
Mm.
And, you will occasionally be able to rely on them for personal support, even if you don't know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has a tent that you can sleep in, maybe.
Yeah.
But of course, in space, you can't do that either.
Mm-hmm.
But what you may have to do, given the mass budgets for some of these missions, is rely on local materials. You may have to get water from whatever planetary body you go to, whether it's for drinking or for insulation against radiation or for making rocket fuel. And so these kind of things you do have to learn to depend on. That's an additional challenge that you may not have to worry about. You may be able to pack in everything to someplace on Earth, but.
Yeah, and I think we have talked this before on how people are actually, working on such ideas of how much you should carry and then how much you could just take there and produce.
And I wonder if this kind of approach is useful as a way to think about how we do some of our own field work here.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some experience in this group with doing field work in the Arctic and the desert and the Antarctic and in the remote forested regions. Each one presents different challenges. But I wonder if there's something to learn from the way he does these things.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly reconnaissance and characterization. Mm-hmm. And there's a style of operation that may be different from what we do. And certainly he travels very light.
Yeah. And I think his adventure show can surely be related to the fact that people are trying this one-way mission to Mars and having a reality show.
Right.
On. So that's kind of adventure show, I would call it. But it's kind of a direct relation. You're trying to survive. You're on your way to Mars. You're not here on Earth anymore. So I think people might be interested, better than any other show, to know how things go.
Yeah, maybe that's what we need to do with our field work, is people watching on television. Right?
Yeah. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Vlogs from next time. Video logs.
Yeah. People. Yeah, there's a good idea.
It's also educational for people to learn about what day-to-day tasks like a typical scientist do.
Yeah. Well,
it's just like Chris Hadfield in the space station. He tweets a lot.
Yeah.
And then that's how he draws all the people fascination about space.
Yeah, and people are quite happy to watch his short videos from space and all of his photos that he sends back.
I mean, we have been doing pictures, right? We have been doing blogs.
That's right.
I think having video would be awesome.
That is, yeah. And it's probably something that we could manage. I mean, we already, we're typically our field teams go in with a fair amount of gear. Twin Otter packed full of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not so hard to have a video camera. There's data and transmission limits, but if they can do it from the space station, we might be able to do it from
Saturday. It doesn't have to be like 1 hour. It's just like a maybe 5 minute of.
Yeah.
What you did.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting way of sharing that kind of work. And of all the work we do, I mean, you know, as interesting as meteorite geochemistry can be, you know, watching somebody in the lab with an X-ray diffractometer might not be that exciting compared to out in the field. Right? Watching people trek across the Arctic looking for a cross. So we have this field component. So maybe there's something we can start doing there. And of course, maybe we can use the radio as a way too.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, certainly plenty of options there, and it's an interesting model, and certainly he's making it work.
Yeah.
In terms of an outreach style.
And people are interested.
Mm-hmm.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Raymond Francis, and Zhengyi Hu. Our editors were Anna Noon and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can make world enough in time to join us again next week, right here, on astronomy.fm.